From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Well, Happy New Year. We're starting off 1992 with a few laughs. Mel Brooks has made some of Hollywood's funniest films, films like The Producers, Blazing Saddles, and High Anxiety. On this edition of Fresh Air, Mel Brooks tells us why he'd rather be Fred Astaire. Also, Nora Dunn. She's a former cast member of Saturday Night Live, where she created characters like model-turned-talk show host Pat Stevens and the lounge act The Sweeney Sisters. And we have a poem from Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Rebels in El Salvador are celebrating the peace accord that was signed with government negotiators early this morning at the United Nations. Tom Gibb visited rebel camps north of the capital.
Leftist rebels fired their guns in the air and shouted in jubilation as the news of the accord was broken. They were told that there will now be a ceasefire from the 1st of February. This will end more than a decade of civil war, which has claimed an estimated 70,000 lives. But not everyone was optimistic. Some of the rebels said they did not believe the government armed forces would comply. On the government side, there's also strong suspicion of the guerrillas. Civilian President Alfredo Cristiani faces a strong opposition campaign from the extreme right wing, which has included death threats against UN officials and foreign journalists. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
United Nations envoy Cyrus Vance said today that both sides in the Yugoslav civil war have agreed to a UN plan to send peacekeeping forces to Croatia. Vance, a former U.S. Secretary of State, told reporters that both Serbian and Croatian leaders appear to be serious about imposing a firm truce. The UN has refused to send peacekeepers until the fighting has stopped. So far, 14 ceasefires in Croatia have been broken as the Serbian-dominated Federal Army and Serbian rebels fight Croatia's secessionist government. Vance appeared skeptical about the prospects for peace when he arrived, but he told reporters that he's seen new steps taken that appear to be serious. The worst flooding may be over for some people in southeast Texas. Authorities believe the Brazos River may have crested. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF in Houston has this report.
Officials expect floodwaters along the lower Brazos River may begin receding by tomorrow. The river crested more than 1.5 feet out of its banks. Flooding is reported in about 30 homes, but officials expect to find water in up to 200 homes when damage surveys are complete in Fort Bend County. Authorities plan to ask this week that Fort Bend be added to the list of federal disaster areas. Already, President Bush has approved federal disaster assistance for 13 Texas counties. Liberty County, east of Houston, is on that list, where 3,500 residents have been affected by the overflowing Trinity River. The Trinity is now 6 feet above its banks. The worst for that area is still to come when the Trinity crests at the end of the week. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir's government has settled a budget dispute that had threatened to break up the conservative coalition with Jewish religious parties. The agreement clears the way for Parliament to vote on the 1992 budget. The dispute was between two religious parties over a $130 million appropriation for religious schools. This is NPR News. Mother Teresa is reported to be alert and in good spirits in La Jolla, California, where she's been hospitalized for pneumonia and heart failure. The 81-year-old Roman Catholic nun was described as seriously ill. She was admitted to the hospital on December 26th after falling ill in Mexico, the last stop on a worldwide tour for the Missionaries of Charity. Mother Teresa won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979 for her work with the homeless in India. In Philadelphia, the Mummers paraded today for the 92nd New Year's Day. Neil Tickner of member station WHYY reports.
Some 25,000 Mummers are strutting the 2.5 miles up Broad Street today in Philadelphia in colorful costumes and to the music. It's nearly a century-old tradition, and the parade retains its down-to-earth neighborhood flavor. The clubs spend much of the year putting their presentations together. Some 47 clubs in all are competing for more than $286,000 in prize money put up by Philadelphia. The parade's scheduled for 12 hours, but the financially struggling city, in order to keep down overtime costs, has told the Mummers to stick to a schedule and that they'll lose $1,000 a minute in prize money for each minute the parade goes over. For National Public Radio, I'm Neil Tickner in Philadelphia.
Stanford University officials are preparing to dispute the results of an upcoming federal audit that may find that the university owes the government as much as $480 million. Stanford President Donald Kennedy and the head of the university's Board of Trustees warned of the coming fight in a statement that will appear later this week in a school publication. A Defense Department audit team has been going over Stanford's books for several months after charges that the university overbilled on research grants. Stanford has acknowledged that there were some inappropriate charges, including the cost of flowers, parties, and furniture at Kennedy's campus home. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Mel Brooks. Among his many achievements is this song, which might be an anthem for the new year. A song by Mel Brooks from his film The 12 Chairs. We're starting the new year with a little bit of bad taste. For example, what's more tasteless than turning the Spanish Inquisition into a lavish song and dance number? How about a Broadway musical saluting Adolf Hitler? These are the kinds of insane spectacles that fans like me love Mel Brooks for. Think of the contributions he's made to American comedy. He was a writer on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. He created The 2,000-Year-Old Man with Carl Reiner, co-created the TV series Get Smart, and made such movies as The Producers, Blazing Saddles, History of the World Part 1, and High Anxiety. We recorded this interview after his latest movie, Life Stinks. Before we meet Mel Brooks, let's listen to a song he wrote for his comedy, The Producers, a film about two Broadway producers who come up with a convoluted scheme to get rich quick by producing the worst musical ever made, Springtime for Hitler.
Germany was having trouble, what a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around, and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Winter for Poland and France.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Come on, Germany.
Some of my very favorite Mel Brooks moments are your big production numbers, your Broadway showstoppers with big choruses for grim and totally inappropriate subjects like Springtime for Hitler and The Producers, or The Inquisition, What a Show, and History of the World, Part 1. Did you want to be on Broadway for real when you were growing up, or did you want to be a song and dance man?
To be perfectly frank, yes. The answer to all those questions is yes, yes! I wanted more than anything. I wanted to sing and dance and jump up and down on Broadway, and even more than that, on the big silver screen. And my heroes when I was young were, of course, Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. And I loved all those great old black and white musicals like The Gay Divorcee and Top Hat and the color movies that MGM made with Gene Kelly, you know, fantastic. And I loved Singing in the Rain. I mean, who doesn't love a great musical? And in all of my movies, whether it's proper or not, I squeeze in a number, you know?
So when you were growing up and you really wanted to be on Broadway or to be a song and dance man, how far did you get with that? Or how far did you think you could get singing and dancing? Did you have...
Oh, I did it. But I did it in the sour cream factories of the Borscht Belt and the Catskills, just outside of New York. There were these resort hotels. And you started by just tending the rowboats or being a busboy, and you prayed to end up on stage, you know, in a variety show on Saturday night. And I became a drummer, and I got onto the stage because the comic got sick. So the boss, Pincus Cohen, redundant name. He didn't need both Pincus and Cohen. One would have been, it would have covered, it would have been a cover. Said, used to call me Melbum, M-E-L-B-M-N-N-N-N. He'd say, Melbum, the comic is sick, and we know you're cute and funny, so jump on the stage and amuse the guests. So that night I went on the stage, and I never went back to the drums.
What'd you do that night?
Well, that night I did a different... It's a good question, Terry. I like you, Terry Gross. This is going to be a great show because I like you and I like me. So when I listen to this, I'm going to be in heaven, you know. What did I do? That night I did a different kind of comedy because there was a maid who was locked in the closet that day. She had somehow locked herself in a broom closet, in a storeroom closet, and she couldn't get out. And she was pounding on the door and screaming in Yiddish, "Lass mir raus! Lass mir raus!" and screaming. And finally somebody heard her, opened the door, and let her out. So they let Sophie out, and she had a little attack of tears and nerves, and then went back to taking care of the rooms. So everybody at the place knew it. It was like a scandal. Poor Sophie. Aye, aye, aye. So when the first thing I did that night, I said, "Good evening, ladies and Jews." You know, I did my part. And I said, "Lass mir raus!" I just screamed, and the place went, it was pandemonium, you know, because they knew about it. And I decided to do like real comedy, people's comedy, or comedy that everybody knew instead of making up, quote, jokes. And I've been doing that kind of comedy ever since.
I want to get back to your big, big lavish production numbers like Springtime for Hitler. What possessed you the first time you did one of those? Like Springtime for Hitler, for instance. It's such a wonderful and really funny number, and I'm sure a lot of people thought it was just in horrible taste.
It was in horrible taste. It was in execrable taste. I'm ashamed of it to this day, but I do like that juxtaposition of those two textures, you know? But let me tell you, the song itself, composed, but nobody knows I wrote the music as well as made up those words. So I wrote the words and the music to Springtime for Hitler. The song is beautiful. People listen to it even today, and they don't know it's Springtime for Hitler. They listen to the orchestration, or they listen to the non-vocal version of it in many cities. I was just in Chicago. There is an elevator playing Springtime for Hitler.
Really?
And there are people going up and down, but it just goes da-da-da-dee-da-da-da-da-da. They don't know it's Springtime for Hitler and Germany. They don't know that. They just hear the music and they sway till they get to the 22nd floor, you know. And it's amazing. And so the melody is almost like a Richard Rodgers melody. And that's why when you hear these crazy words against it, it all falls into place beautifully.
What do you think your most misunderstood scene is in any of your movies?
I think it's a good question, Terry Gross. That's a very good question. What is my most misunderstood or misinterpreted theme? Yeah, vulgarity or bad taste. I use it, therefore I'm painted with that brush. The critics and a lot of people don't understand that bad taste is a wonderful device for unearthing truth that is all around us and evoking laughter. So that is the bane of my existence, is that I'm continually accused, like the overhead shot of the swastika in Springtime for Hitler. I mean, it was a very important point in a very important musical and a very important story. So I don't think they just single out, you know, something that they feel is in horrible taste, but they don't know that it's it's used to illuminate something.
My guest is Mel Brooks. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter, director, and actor Mel Brooks is my guest. His new movie is Life Stinks. What kind of roles do you think you would have gotten if you weren't writing your own?
Oh, my favorite role would be the King of Germany, the Kaiser role. That would be, no. Two demerits for that. I can't help. Look, when you work in the mountains, it never leaves you. You know, cheap jokes. I mean, I'm a purveyor of cheap jokes. Now, what kind of roles would I say again, Terry?
What kind of roles do you think you would have gotten in movies if you weren't writing your own?
Well, in the 30s, I probably would have been a bellboy in hotel movies. And then I guess in the 40s, I would have been, a good-natured soldier from Brooklyn. I know the roles they would have given me. They would have called me Brooklyn. Hey, Brooklyn, you know? And then In the 50s, I would have been the band boy with the rock and roll group, touring this. I know, that's why I wrote these movies, or else I would have been stuck with all these parts. I would have been called Blinky and Winky and Nod.
Before you started writing for the Sid Caesar Show, did you have any outwardly Jewish people to see yourself in, outside of the Catskill comics, but people who were not only Jewish in show business, but were doing sketches about being Jewish, or who were writing stories about being Jewish, or, who were Jewish in any outward way?
Good question. No. The only role models had gone away, and that was Yiddish theater. The Yiddish theater of Second Avenue in New York. And that was long gone by the time I had made my way into show business. I had only seen one play. And the second act of the Yiddish theater was an incredible device. It was great. It was the most emotional point in the play. This is the second act curtain I'm talking about, before you went into the third act. This is to hold the audience so they would sit for the third act. And the daughter would come home to them. She was missing, and she would come home. And she would enter stage left, and the mother was stage right looking at her. And she would open her coat, and she would show this big belly. And the mother would scream in Yiddish, "Er ist schwanger!" And she'd faint, and the curtain would come down. And that is, the mother would say, "She's pregnant." And they always had, or a soldier would come home and the mother would say, "It is blind, he's blind," and then the curtain would come. I mean, they always had this, they had these tragically emotional moments. And I learned that somehow, at the end of the second act, and I do that in all my movies, you've got to hook the people so they're excited about at least the denouement. I mean, the rush to the end,
Your parents were Eastern European immigrants. Was mostly Yiddish spoken in your house?
No. My grandmother did. My mother, as a matter of fact, said Earl and Burl. She was a New Yorker. She came here when she was 3 years old. She learned English from, as most immigrants did when they came here as little kids, they learned English from Irish teachers. Irish teachers in New York. And they were the Irish got all the jobs, so therefore all the teachers were Irish, and everybody was talking like this in Jewish households. Hey, Mershi, would you pass the kasha? Thank you very much, Mersh. I mean, I'm overdoing it, but my mother did say turlet. She never said toilet. She said turlet, like the Irish do.
If you're just joining us, Mel Brooks is my guest, and his new movie is called Life Stinks. He co-wrote it, he directed it, and he stars in it. Can I hear about what your bar mitzvah was like?
It was fast and short. In those days, they were not. Today, I just went to a bar mitzvah, and it could have fed all of Kiev, where my mother came from. It's an amazing difference. My bar mitzvah took 15 minutes, and the kids threw hard candy, and a couple of them hit me with it, and it was all over. And of course, I'll never forget the breath of my Rebbe. I mean, Rebbe breath is famous. I mean, they eat garlics and onions, and then they try to teach you Hebrew, and they would breathe in your face and say, no, not chu, not, and it was quite an experience. And ask any little Jewish kid who's bar mitzvah about Rebbe breath.
A lot of your movies are parodies of genre films. When did you fall in love with movies? Did you go a lot when you were young?
I went a lot, and I didn't have a lot of money, so the way I used to get into movies was when the audience, who just when the movie would break and the audience would walk out, I would join them and I would walk backwards until I was in the theater.
Oh, so it looked like you were exiting.
In the back row, yeah. And then when the new audience came in, I mean, I would watch the movie. And that was the only way I could get to see movies, because I couldn't afford the whatever it was, the 15 cents to get in to see them. And my mother used to search for me in the movies, because I would see the same movie, you know, if it was Top Hat or The Gay Divorce, forget about it. I'd see it 16 times. I knew every step. I knew every nuance, every lilt, every note, every fill. I was addicted. I was addicted to movies.
I want to get back to something we were talking about before. You know how you were saying if you weren't writing your own roles, you'd be like the bellboy in the movie or whatever. When you realized that as much as you loved song and dance and Broadway shows and musical comedy movies, when you realized that you probably weren't going to be a leading man, you weren't going to be cast as a leading man, well, eventually you started casting yourself as a leading man in parodies of those kinds of movies. But were you ever really heartbroken knowing that you wouldn't be in the serious versions of those movies?
That's a good question, yeah. In my heart of hearts, I always wanted to be Errol Flynn. Yeah, I was heartbroken. And I always wanted the most beautiful, long-waisted, long-legged women in the world to fall on their knees and pray to me. But as life and God would have it, it was the other way around. Every time I see a tall, beautiful woman, I just crash to my knees and I pray to her. I say, please, just give me a slap in the face, something. Show me that you know I'm alive too. I made myself a leading man in High Anxiety because I always wanted to imitate Frank Sinatra. So here was a chance to write a song called High Anxiety and sing it at a bar, which was a dream of mine. And I made myself... I made myself a leading man because in real life I knew I could never be a leading man.
Well, I'm going to play some of High Anxiety.
Oh, thanks, Tara.
High anxiety whenever you're near. High anxiety, it's you that I fear. My heart's afraid to fly, it's crashed before. But then you take my hand, my heart starts to soar. Once more, high anxiety, it's always the same. Anxiety, it's you that I blame. It's very clear to me I've got to give in. High anxiety, you win.
Mel Brooks, I want to get to a different side of what you do, and that's the movies that you produce. Because, you know, Brooks Films has done movies like The Elephant Man, and you had David Lynch direct that, and The Fly, mm-hmm. David Cronenberg directed that. What I'm interested in here is that it seems to me you produce these serious, moody films that are so different from the kinds of films you direct and write and star in. It seems like it's another part of you, but it's one that I guess you feel more comfortable in the position of producer rather than writer or director or star.
True. Because I have not been allowed to do, quote, serious things, allowed by my image, you do something and then the public and the critics, too, want you to do it until you're dead. And they won't allow you to change your shape or form or express yourself in a different manner because, you know, hey, pal, you know, we're paying for vanilla. You know, don't give us chocolate. And so I formed this kind of sub rosa under the table in the closet company called Brooks Films. And I kept my name, the Mel. I keep the Mel away, I said.
But are these films that you would like to be making yourself in a way?
Well, in a way, I've kind of put it together in Life Stinks. And it's kind of the first time I've stepped out of the closet. So here I am, Mel Brooks and Brooks Films all in one movie. And I'm very happy with it. You know, I'm very happy I was allowed to do it. And it was a great experience. But I've never been allowed to fuse the quiet, dark, serious elements in me and the happy-go-lucky, silly comic.
So many of your movies seem to be about, isn't it absurd that I would be in this position here? Or isn't it absurd that a Jew like me would be in this position here? I'm wondering about the circumstances in your life where you felt like the Jew. Were there instances where you felt that way, or did you grow up in a neighborhood where just about everybody was Jewish and came from families and background
like
you did?
Actually, I felt I had great compassion and pity for the few Catholic people that were living in our ghetto because in Williamsburg in Brooklyn, because I felt these poor people, these Christians. I mean, they're in the minority. We should help them. We should be kind to them, you know. I never thought that we, you know. And then I was drafted, and I was in the Army, and I said, wait a minute. I mean, there are 10,000 guys here, and I'm the only Jew. What's happened, you know? I began to realize that maybe we weren't the majority, and, you know. Anyway, I think that I learned a lot. I learned a lot because there were people who hated me in the Army just because they found out I was a Jew. And then I made sure that they got to know me and not just what, you know, they thought I was. And usually I could make sense to them about who I was and what I was, you know. It was really interesting. I mean, the Army was a very interesting experience. Of course, war is very loud and people are trying to kill you. I mean, they don't even know your last name, and they're shooting at you, you know? So it's very, very disturbing. I mean, it's not, it's not what I want to do for the rest of my life. I knew that. After my first combat where these Germans were trying to kill me, I said, I'm going to get into show business. I knew that that's what I wanted to do. Singing and dancing was going to be a lot better than this. War is heck.
Well, Mel Brooks, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay, Terry Gross. Keep in touch. Don't be strange. And keep up the great work. I love your stuff. Say hello to Philadelphia for me. Bye-bye.
Mel Brooks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Dachetovich, sweet Georgie Brown. Dajca wusa, poleć wusa, sweet Georgie Brown. Ja przez ciebie będę w niebie, sweet Georgie Brown. Mój los dobrze znasz, ten co pewnie masz. Okej. Okay. Mój kolega nie ostrzega, ratuje pan. On nas z każdym panem ważnym, ten co ma plan. Będzie biło serce twoje, bliżej bracie zdrowie swoje. Georgie bija, Georgie żyja, swiry pyry Georgie Brown. Nasz, masz, masz, crash, bo Brown. Ba-ra-bi-ba-ba-ba-ba, wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-wo-
down.
Ты нас давже знаешь.
That's a failure march.
Okay.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, some fashion tips from model turned talk show host Pat Stevens. And we hear from Stevens' creator, Nora Dunn. Dunn is a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. In her one-woman show, she brings back the characters she originated on Saturday Night Live, like Pat Stevens, Liz Sweeney of the Lounge Act, the Sweeney Sisters, and the sex kitten Babette. Also, Mark Halliday reads his poem, Life's Bounty. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, a UN-sponsored peace agreement reached early this morning between the government of El Salvador and left-wing rebels calls for a ceasefire beginning next month, with the aim of establishing a lasting peace by the end of October. Christopher Gunnis of the BBC reports from the UN.
The agreement brings into effect a ceasefire on the 1st of February, which will lead to the establishment of lasting peace on the 31st of October. The two parties will reconvene on the 5th of January to conclude an overall peace settlement, which according to the plan must be achieved by the 14th of January. The 75-page document outlines details on scaling down the Salvadoran army and the integration of the FMLN into a new civilian police force. Agreement was also reached on social and economic issues, such as land reform. One official said as he left the signing ceremony that after 12 years of bloody conflict, El Salvador would at last see peace.
Christopher Gunnis, the BBC at the UN. It's been a day off for consumers in Russia who face price increases on most consumer items. Across-the-board price increases will start tomorrow, as the first shock of Russian President Boris Yeltsin's economic reform plans. In his New Year's address, Yeltsin said on January 2nd, probably the most painful measure will begin, the freeing of prices. The Soviet state economy involved subsidizing just about all items, and consumer prices were well below actual expenses. Government officials hope that high prices will increase production and bring goods back to Russian shelves. A New Year's holiday did not stop the fighting in Tbilisi, Georgia, while the unofficial death toll is now 75. The news agency TASS says the death toll could be four times that figure. Several hundred other people have been wounded. Carol Walker filed this report for the BBC and reports that the opposition is now using large artillery, while forces loyal to the president have machine guns.
The loose alliance of militia groups attempting to oust President Gamsakhourdia resorted to the large howitzer field guns they acquired yesterday. The deafening booms shattered windows nearby. Forces loyal to the president returned fire. Snipers in a number of buildings targeted the opposition headquarters. Tracer and machine gun bullets sprayed into the square just beyond it.
Fighting has now spread beyond the center of the capital to other government buildings and to the outskirts of the city itself. Iraq has recognized all 15 former republics of the Soviet Union as independent states. Iraq had close relations with the former Soviet Union until its invasion of Kuwait in August of 1990. This is National Public Radio News. Yugoslavia's step has been taken that appears to be the best chance in months for civil warfare to end. Special UN envoy Cyrus Vance says that both sides in the fighting in Croatia have now accepted a plan to send peacekeepers to the region. Vance said that Serbian and Croatian leaders have taken steps that he has not seen before and appears serious about imposing a ceasefire. UN officials have said that the fighting has to stop before peacekeeping observers will be sent in. However, fighting continues in several parts of Croatia, and Vance says that he cannot predict when observers might be deployed. 14 previous ceasefire agreements have broken down. Willie Harrington has been sworn into office as the first black mayor of Memphis, Tennessee. And as NPR's David Mopus reports, the new mayor is facing several problems.
Harrington is being hailed by blacks as a champion of the poor who will revitalize jobs, housing, and schools. But his most immediate challenge will be to improve race relations. Harrington's razor-thin victory, along with black control of the Memphis City Council and school board, could accelerate white flight to the suburbs and worsen the city's declining tax base. The task of reassuring whites, who control most of the city's wealth, and empowering blacks, who put him in office, is a dicey proposition. In his first appointments, Harrington chose whites for several key jobs. That drew praise from corporate executives, but fire from some black activists. I'm David Malpas reporting.
Florida's Republican Party says that David Duke will not be included in its March primary list of presidential candidates. GOP State Chairman Van Poole says that President Bush and commentator Pat Buchanan are the only names that should appear on the GOP primary ballot. Candidates have 2 weeks to file appeals with the state election committee, and Duke supporters say they plan to do so. If this fails, they say that they will go to court. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's been 2 seasons since Nora Dunn left Saturday Night Live. As you may remember, she left after refusing to appear on the same show with comic Andrew Dice Clay. But she's kept alive some of the characters she created for Saturday Night Live, like model-turned-talk show host Pat Stevens, lounge singer Liz Sweeney of the Sweeney Sisters, and sex kitten Babette. She wrote new material for them in her book Nobody's Rib. That's also the name of her one-woman show. She told me that Pat Stevens was based on a woman who used to come talk to her class in school.
She was patterned after a woman named Connie, who used to come to my high school and talk to us about an exciting career in makeup and modeling. And she was very disconnected to anything else, any other reality. And I went to a inner-city high school in Chicago and went through the tumultuous, you know, end of the 60s there, and we had a lot of racial problems and a lot of intensity. And in the midst of it all, the nuns would have Connie. And she'd talk like this. And she would just, you know, get up and say, you know, ask us questions and show us how to stand. Of course, you always said, you know, you stand with your, and sit with the knees in the locked position. So that's how she stemmed out of her. I used to call my friends on the phone as Connie, and they always bought it, you know, and they would somehow get, you know, finagled into coming down to the School of Beauty Culture and taking a tour.
Just come down Saturday. Let's just show you what we've got here to offer.
So she came out of that.
So how would you shop for Pat Stevens?
Well, I wouldn't shop for him. I mean, she does definitely does her own shopping. Loves to shop. In fact, when she writes these, there's some beat poems in the book, and Pat became a beat poet. She was in Chicago, and she was wanted to go to a zoo. And she mistakenly went to the Art Institute because there were two big lions on the outside. When she walked in here, she wasn't in an art museum, and there was lots of course, big pictures, which she liked. And she runs into a poet there who talks her into going to a poetry slam, and she thinks she's going dancing. And she goes and hears poems, and then she begins writing her own poems and calls her psychiatrist later, and he tells her, well, you know, you need to go shopping. So she goes and she buys the whole Shiseido line and gets herself back, never writes another poem again.
Do you want to do one of the poems for us?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. Let me see. This one is called, I'll read it as Pat. Imelda, we hardly knew ya. I remember how deeply she grieves from inside her puffy sleeves. Her eyes are puffy, too. Well, wouldn't you cry? I mean, why did they have to keep her shoes? That was wrong. They belonged to her. No wonder she sings the blues. At least she looks best in that color.
That's good. That's
and
very good.
The one I like a lot is, here's my favorite. This one is called,
Jackie is 60. I can't believe it. Jackie Onassis. Jackie, oh. Jackie Kennedy. Jackie rose up. Jackie, you rose up. You made your fortune. You found Maurice or he, you or you, he, whatever will be, will be. Jackie Jack. Jackie Shack. Jackie come back. Caroline, John, baby Rose, blow her nose. There she goes. She's walking now, Jackie. Oh, Jackie, you live in the now somehow. Art, culture, a beaded evening bag. Never an old bag or an old hag. Jackie will never let us down. I wish she could wear a crown on Martha's Vineyard or a pillbox hat. But what's not is not. I've said goodbye to Camelot. I won't cry. Don't die, Jackie. Oh, Jackie, don't die, please.
That's wonderful. That's a Cat Stevens performance poet.
Yeah. It struck me as very funny when I started writing. I could have written these things forever, these little Pat Beat poems. That was fun.
You used to write poetry yourself, didn't you?
I mean, did.
Real poems? Yeah.
Yeah, I did. In fact, you know, I write short stories. I wanted to put some in the book, but they weren't really quite appropriate. They're not as humorous as this. This is a book of humorous collections. But someday I really would love to get some of my stories published and some of the poetry published.
My guest is comedian Nora Dunn. She is a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. She's currently touring the country with her one-woman show called Nobody's Rib. It's also the title of her new book. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Actress and writer Nora Dunn is my guest. You left Saturday Night Live, and that coincided with your refusal to be on the same show as Andrew Dice Clay.
Mm-hmm.
Were you fired or did you quit?
No, I wasn't fired. You know, I came back the next week and did the show. My contract was up that year, which they did not renew my contract. I did not ask them to renew my contract. So it was a mutual separation. I was on the show for a long time, and it was ready, you know, I was ready not to be on the show, and I didn't want to leave on a controversial kind of a note. It just happened that way, but I really wasn't going to come back for a sixth year on the show.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to take the stand that you did when they booked Andrew Dice Clay to be the guest host?
Well, it was a surprise to me. I didn't know he was the guest host until Monday, and my husband knew and didn't tell me all weekend because he knew that I would be very upset. And I felt really hurt by it. That was my first reaction, is why would they have him on the show? I know he's got a movie coming out and so forth, but... And it's not because he's controversial, and it's not because he says bad words on the stage. It's definitely the content of the material and the hatefulness of it and the anti-humanistic quality of that kind of comedy. I think it's such a fascist tone to it, and it just goes against every shred of feeling of integrity that I have about my own work. And I had struggled on the show somewhat. A lot of sketches I didn't want to do, and the writers knew that there was a lot of stuff that I thought was in bad taste. They went ahead and did it. That was the nature of the show. There was everybody writing all nature of material. So, and sometimes I think I was possibly too cautious in what I wanted to be identified with when it comes to humor and comedy. But this was something that I knew I wouldn't be able to write a satirical sketch that was hard-hitting enough to say what I had to say, and certainly there's no guarantee that it would have been on the air. And I really couldn't face the idea of going out for good nights and standing up there with a big smile on my face and waving to the audience when I would have felt that what we did was a betrayal to the quality and the integrity of all the seasons of Saturday Night Live. You know, everything that show stood for me from the very beginning.
Had you seen Andrew Dice Clay's work?
I had seen parts of his HBO special, and I went out and got a CD that day, Monday, because I thought, well, I better really listen to his latest piece and see, maybe this is sort of grounded in some kind of an anger, or maybe it's just black comedy, and maybe I'm not getting it. So I bought his latest, and it was just hate humor.
I'm glad you said that you actually went out and listened to it,
yeah,
to decide what you really thought of it, as opposed to just operating by what you thought he was probably doing as opposed to what he was really doing.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, we have expectations that are wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. And sometimes you misinterpret what someone's doing.
Yeah, right. Right.
And I also felt that there was all of that time for him to explain it in any kind of a satirical context. And it's clear that he doesn't. It's clear that it doesn't come from any source of intelligence. And it's very exploitive. It exploits people's fears. And comedies ought to, you know, release that.
So did you get any support from the other performers on the show?
I don't think they were indifferent about it. They didn't quite know what to do. And I also was under a different contract than the cast came a year later than me. They had another year, and I think they felt that they had to play it safer than I felt I did. Which is not to say if I had another year, it would have been any different, because I tend to fly off the handle on these kinds of things. I'm not calm about it. But I think for them, they felt a little frightened. And no one that I work with on the cast is that kind of a person. None of them were really very confrontational, very creative, very, very funny group. But I wouldn't think it would be characteristic for them to have done that kind of thing.
You said that there had been a lot of sketches that you really didn't want to participate in because you thought they were in bad taste. What kinds of sketches?
Well, some of them I just was uncomfortable with their real insensitivity to women. I really got tired of whores, and I didn't want to play them. And it's not because I'm just tired of it. It's a tedious characterization, and there was just too much of it. And there seemed to be only two characters that these guys could write, and one was the kind of a promiscuous, hoary type of girl, and the other was a housewife who may as well have had a lobotomy. Almost every housewife I played, or mother, you know, had about two lines and kind of sat with her head bobbing. And when Jan and I did stuff together, it was always very... the characters had integrity. The Sweeney sisters really, they believed in themselves. We weren't making them losers or making fun of them as losers. They were real successful in their eyes. Same thing with Pat Stevens. You know, I had to struggle a lot not to have the legs pulled out from underneath her as to actually what she is about. And it was, you know, you kind of had to beat them off your work so much. To just get them to say, no, it's not girl humor, it's just humor. And so often we heard, well, I don't get girl humor. All right, we're going to do a woman sketch this week. So it was always kind of boxed off in the corner here. You kind of feel like women and children over here and men over here. And I just got tired of it. And there were quite a few pieces like that that were just, I just felt they were old. I just felt they just weren't... now. They might have been appropriate 15 years ago, but they're just not appropriate now.
What's the difference between the whorish kinds of roles you didn't want to play in sketches and the Babette the Sex Kitten role you came up with for yourself?
Well, Babette is, she's a sex kitten because a sex kitten never dies, we just get fluffy. The intent of Babette is that her idea of a strong woman is very distorted. She's proud of her film. She did a portrait of woman. You know, woman came from the French made woman because we took the tiny word men, which is an American word, and we put the French word woo in front of it. So that is how we get woman. But I am a strong, fluffy sex kitten. I did film always for a strong woman role, and that's why I made... I was a firefighter in female firefighter Centerfold USA. I was in all these film. I made a portrait series for television, and this was to cover women in all walk of life. I made portrait of an escort, portrait of a showgirl, portrait of a naked slut on drugs, portrait of a female cop on crack. I also play the woman who is so angry, she's pursuing a serial killer rapist, and she kills him while he is being electrocuted in the electric chair. So she's all these roles she's played that are her. She thinks that is strong. Even in Gunload, I was in Gunload, and they play an aerobic instructor who is so strong that she's working out of the stairmaster,
and the criminal comes into the room, blows off of her head with an AK-47, but she still continues to work out without her head. And finishes her workout 45 minutes, and then she dies, only after the workout.
So that's her point. It's not, there's something else there.
I really love what you're getting at with the character, which is someone who manages to turn all these kind of sexist stereotypes of women into strength. Mm-hmm. Look how strong I am.
Yeah.
Before you got into comedy, you were a writer, you were a painter, you went to art school, and then it was after that that you went to San Francisco and took some acting lessons, mm-hmm. and then started performing at comedy clubs. What led you to try comedy?
Well, I studied acting for a couple of years, and I had these characters that I did on my own. And a friend of mine that I met in acting class was a comedian, and he said, you should just do some of these characters on stage or do them for a monologue. And so I started doing my characters on the stage, and it just sort of, it was one of those things that once I started doing it, even though I was absolutely terrified, it was terrifying, when it worked, the feeling was great. So I just kept writing them.
What was the worst humiliation that you faced on stage?
Oh, God, there's so many. But I remember one night these people came up from Los Angeles, and there was always somebody coming up to see, and I got to be part of 10 comics, but I went on last. By the time I went on, the whole audience had left, and it was just these judges, you know. And I put a, I had, at the time I used to wear things, I had a wig on, and I was in this whole character, and I got up and did it, and I did not know how to get off the stage, and I just eventually just kind of stopped, and I wanted to get down and just slither off like a snake, but I didn't even have the courage to do that. I just sort of wandered off the stage, and it was Kevin Meaney who was there and was so nice to me, because most comics would just, you know, run as you came if you failed, and he came up and said, "That must have been just terrible for you."
Oh, that's really encouraging.
And I said, "Thank you." Oh, no, it made me feel great, because it was terrible. And I wanted so much just for someone to go, "God, you know, let's go have a drink."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "That wasn't your fault." Another time I was in Chicago with Christine Zander, who's a writer on Saturday Night Live, and we performed together. And we did a show at this theater, and my mom and dad were in town, and they came to the show, and there was only two other people in the audience.
Oh, God.
And we did the show, and it was a total failure. And I remember my father coming up after the show, and he said, "You know, I don't think it was you. I really think it was the audience." But those things you wear like badges. All the failures are what you learn by, and then the triumphs are just feel good. Mm.
Nora Dunn. Her book is called Nobody's Rib. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, it's Noah Adams, National Public Radio, with a word about what's coming up at All Things Considered. There's a peace agreement reached between the government of El Salvador and the rebel forces fighting for control of that country for more than a decade. A ceasefire is scheduled for the 1st of February. I'll talk with Carol Walker, a reporter for the BBC in Tbilisi in Georgia, about the fighting there, efforts to overthrow that government. Two Swarthmore students of Croatian background talk with us about a rap song they've written and performed. It's said to be a hit in Zagreb. It's called Croatia's Gotta Be Free. And Karen Michelle takes us on a food tour of Brooklyn to inaugurate a new cookbook. That and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The new year is a time for reflection. Mark Halliday has a poem for us called Life's Bounty.
Life's Bounty. Hungry at midnight, you open the refrigerator in a dark kitchen and wow, Shangri-La. The green and red and orange foods in their cartons and jars, olives, juices, chocolate syrup, yellow butter, brown bread, and back by the blessed blazing bulb, leftover spaghetti sauce with latent power in its deep Mediterranean redness. As life goes on, There will be times when I feel that a sudden alertness to life's bounty, e.g. food, is enough to make a poem, a celebration sort of poem, and I'll write it and feel okay about it, but it won't be a poem that really matters to me or you, because interesting truth, like interesting pleasure, is so triple-edged and marbled. It's so mixy. Either the snack you fix turns out to be stale, or you're thinking about your father's anger or your spouse's bad luck or your next job, and you don't quite taste it. Or the snack is delicious and you eat it and then it's gone, and soon you go to sleep. What we need is some complication of the idea of life's bounty, how its mixiness is actually inseparable from our sometimes loving it, the thrill of joy being that you know the joy is both unlikely and temporary. If you could fully have your way, it wouldn't stay your way for long. How did Wallace Stevens put it? He said, "Delight, since the imperfect is so hot in us, lies in flawed words and stubborn sounds." I love being able to quote those lines. I love the fact that they're his and not mine, while I worry that mine are nothing next to his, while I worry that he wouldn't admire my use of them. And when you love seriously, you love something, a dog, a poem, a lover or friend, for being more independent and complicated than your selfishness would have planned. Now, the personal example I'd have expected myself to give at this point might have involved a love affair, quote, "and when I watched her slide out of bed at dawn, dot, dot, dot." But I was just remembering a dinner at Mike's Gourmet Fast Foods with Annie and Peter and Peter's three-year-old niece, Katie. I had a mocha frapp, three scoops, with the third scoop floating, a Swiss burger, and an order of fried mushrooms. Katie grew tired of her large vanilla cone much too soon and wanted to ramble. One of us had to keep tabs on her, while the other two chewed fast so we could take her home from the too exciting drive-in and coax her towards sleep. I'm not good at chewing fast. I try to savor things. The dinner quad dinner was thus not wholly satisfying. But I like the memory, the whole memory. Annie laughing when she caught Katie's scoop barehanded as it fell from her upended cone, and Peter resisting being charmed by his nuisance niece as she stood on the hood of our Fiesta and danced and sang, "I Don't Want to Go Home."
Poet Mark Halliday.
Hey! I don't want to go home!
Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Sherrock, and Seuss Bolan. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year.
Lord, I know that it's getting late.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Seinfeld is a sitcom starring comic Jerry Seinfeld as a comic named Jerry Seinfeld. You'd think that this was a very autobiographical show, but a lot of the stories come from the life of head writer and executive producer Larry David, a former stand-up comic. We'll talk with Larry David on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.